that it had rattled her to try to slip into her father's mind, to know that the general's mind and her own felt upsettingly similar. She'd wanted to put her fear inside a white box and give it to Aaron. "You, too," she would tell him. "I fear for you. I fear for me if I lost you."
"War is no place for fear," said the memory of her father's voice.
"Take care," she'd told Aaron. He'd smiled. And now he was below, out of sight, beyond the curve of the empty road. The sun poured down. The gunners had loaded their weapons. Kestrel watched the road, dagger ready. Cicadas, the flit of bird wings. Maybe her father had recognized that the coded letter was false. Maybe he wouldn't take the bait. A breath of wind. Hours passed, slow as a sweat traveling down Kestrel's back. Her limbs ached from being in the same position. She felt a strange energy slip over her and the gunners, an elastic tension that went tight at the smallest sound, then slackened in the heat, the waiting. Dream, wait, startle, wait, dream. The gunners, like her, crouched among ferns and saplings, guns angled down. Small eastern crossbows were at the ready. A siren tree dripped orange sap, its spindly branches low and sticky. Kestrel watched the road. The rapid tuck-tuck-tuck of a bird's beak against bark, the brush of leaves. Then, faintly, stronger, the rhythm of thousands of boots on the paved road. 28. Aaron heard the Valorians marching toward him. The sound made his chest harden with anticipation. The Valorians neared. Still hidden behind the bend in the road, Aaron turned to catch the eyes of his soldiers, no more than 50 of them, men and women, Harani and Dokran both. All of them on foot, for stealth and to appear more vulnerable to the Valorian front lines. Some of the Harani soldiers had lined their eyes in orange and red, like Dokran warriors. The sound of the Valorian army became deafening. Boots and hooves and wagon wheels, heavy armor, metal on metal. His gaze on his soldiers, theirs on him. Aaron lifted his hand. Wait. He edged around a tree to look down the road. The Valorian cavalry, enormous war horses, officers in black and gold. Close. And one Valorian in particular, leading them, looking no different than he had 11 years ago. Large and armored, his insignia painted across the chest. A woven baldric over his chest, knotted at the shoulder. Helmet simple, made to show his face. That face. Good, to have a little distance, to not quite see the general's light brown eyes, too much like his daughter's. Better, to have this man move his horse nearer to Aaron, almost within his reach.
"Do you want him?" Aaron's god whispered. "Do you want to crush him between your hands?"
Aaron glanced back at his company.
"Ready,"
he whispered, then whispered it again in Dokran. His sword was drawn. His blood was hot.
"Sweet child. Mine own. Go!"
Kestrel saw the clash from above. Through a spyglass, she watched Valorian warhorses rear. Not the general's. He became motionless, a metal statue. His face was far away, his features a blur. Her stomach clenched. And Aaron? Trees obscured her view. She couldn't find him. She couldn't see anything below the horse's shoulders. Infantry against cavalry.
Kestrel, you fool.
She realized that she must have believed in Aaron's god. Some unexamined part of her must resolutely trust the god of death's protection. Only that could explain why she had set Aaron against the Valorian vanguard. And her father, with any hope of survival. Dread worked its way up her throat. In the initial crush, Aaron lost sight of the general. An officer's horse nearly trampled Aaron, who dodged the reared front hooves. He caught a blow from the Valorian sword. Its edge lodged harmlessly in the shoulder of Aaron's hardened leather armor. As the man tugged it free, Aaron snatched the reins from the man's hand and dragged the horse's head down, heard it scream. The Valorian struggled to keep his seat. Arryn buried the point of his sword into the man's side above his hip, just below the low border of the metal cuirass. Arryn pushed. An inhuman sound. Blood channeled down the blade. Arryn's hand was warm and wet. The Valorian started to slide from his saddle, his foot caught in the stirrup. The greave of his leg armor raked the horse's side, and the animal reared again, nearly dislocating Arryn's arm from his shoulder. He released the reins. The Valorian thumped to the ground. The horse plunged, ran wild, dragging the soldier behind him. Arryn couldn't think. He knew vaguely that enemy archers weren't firing on his company, probably for fear of hitting the Valorian vanguard. He knew that his own soldiers were falling around him. The Valorians, instead of pulling forward to meet the attack, stood their ground and grew more compact, a wall of metal and horses. Those stallions, the gorgeous brawn of them, high and huge. Arryn shouted in Dacran, then in his own tongue.
"With me!"
He drew his dagger. A blade in each hand, he ducked into the narrow space between two Valorian warhorses and sliced open their necks. Kestrel clenched the spyglass. The Valorian officers didn't advance, didn't separate from the middle ranks, didn't expose the supply wagons. A warhorse stumbled, then another. Her father hacked his sword down. It rose up red. She saw him shout.
"Cut the ropes!" Kestrel told her gunners. "Now!"
Arryn wanted to cry out. He saw an eastern woman slip past the Valorian defenses, hamstring a warhorse and reach the general. Arryn wanted to say, "No!" He wanted to say, "Mine!" The general, steady on his steady horse, swung. He cut the woman's head from her neck. Blood jetted.
"Hold formation!"
the man shouted. The rest of the general's commands echoed in Arryn's ears as he blocked the downswing of a horsed Valorian's blade.
"Rear guard, close ranks!"
Arryn's sword arm ached.
"Archers, eyes on the hills! Cannons, at the ready!"
He dropped the dagger from his left hand, hooked his free fingers into the Valorian's leg armor at the upper thigh, and yanked.
"Flankers, defend!"
The Valorian toppled from his horse. Sword into the fallen man's throat. A gurgling cry. The general wasn't fooled. He'd guessed this was no little skirmish. He held his vanguard back and let Arryn's company come in order to tighten ranks in defense against a larger attack. A horse shifted. A path opened between Arryn and the general.
"Ah, yes," murmured Arryn's god.
Then a rough, tumbling crash roared over the sounds of war. Arryn almost didn't know what it meant until a crack broke the air. The trees groaned, tipped forward, and thudded down. Most lay where they fell, but a few slid down the hill toward the road. They gathered speed, slammed into boulders or the trunks of other trees. Some speared down, leafy tops first, stopped by nothing or shunted by an obstacle into a diagonal roll that spun them off the hill and onto the Valorian army's left flank. The trees crushed men and women, cut a swath into the middle ranks. Noise rang through the hills. Each thump and scream split the air. It sounded worse to Kestrel as the echoes died. She didn't want to hear silence.
"Ready a volley," she told the gunners. "Aim at the middle ranks. Target archers. Drop the flankers. Drop anyone near a cannon. Cut a hole around the supply wagons."
The gunners' faces were unafraid. Their position was mostly secure, well out of range of Valorian arrows. Cannons might be a problem, but the army below was still fumbling to unhitch cannons from draft horses and unload ordnance from the wagons. Kestrel was about to disrupt that.
"Matches,"
she said. They were struck.
"Light."
Short fuses burned.
"Aim."
Gunfire perforated the air. Arryn heard what he couldn't see. The song of metal sailing through space. Iron balls, each no bigger than a small stone, hailed down. They punched into metal, rang on stone, drove into flash. Guttural screams. Arryn saw the general's face go gray. Horse carcasses lay between Arryn and the general. The shuddering wave of a stallion trying and failing to stand. The pitiable arch and flop of the horse's neck. And Valorians, two rows of them, trying to hold the front lines, confused, frightened, their eyes not where they should be. Arryn pushed forward. Another volley of gunfire. Far away beyond the Valorian army came a new sound. Hooves rattled fast up the road. There was a shrieking clash. Roshar's company must have struck the rear guard. The general shouted something incoherent to Arryn. The Valorian formation wobbled, seemed ready to dissolve. Then a cannon boomed from the central ranks. A second cannon. The world became too loud for Arryn to understand anything he heard, too fast for him to understand more than what his body did, and did again. Blood was in his mouth. His hands were slippery. His muscles were loose and alive. A cannonball thudded into the hillside, not far below the gunners. Kestrel felt the impacts tremor in the earth. It vibrated the soles of her boots. It trembled the thin, gummy twigs of siren trees. "Again," she told the gunners. But despite the gunfire, despite an attack on three fronts, the Valorian army didn't collapse or panic. The rear guard countered Rashar's attack. The Valorian army, thousands strong, segmented into three, front, middle, and rear ranks. But Arryn's company, from what Kestrel saw, couldn't drive through the vanguard to reach the center. The rear guard's defenses were better than she'd hoped. Rashar made little headway. Even divided, the Valorians would overcome their attacks. The only way to cripple Kestrel's enemy for the long term was to destroy the supplies. But the guns, deadly though they were, weren't precise enough in their aim. They couldn't open a path for either Arryn's or Rashar's company to reach the supply wagons. Anxiety clawed her belly. Rashar, she thought, would have the good sense to retreat if he must. She wasn't so sure about Arryn. She thought that if she couldn't drag a victory out of this battle, he'd struggle against the vanguard until it overwhelmed him.
"The solution is simple," her father whispered inside her.
Kestrel didn't know whether it was a memory or her imagination.
"If you can do it."
She looked at the siren trees. Their sap oozed. She heard the plunk of an iron ball dropped into its chamber, the dry pour of black powder. As the gunners reloaded their guns, Kestrel shakily tucked her braid into her leather helmet. She could do nothing about the obvious Valorian style of her armor. She remembered how she'd been uncertain whether she wanted her father to see her. A shudder ran through her. No, not seen. Never. Whatever happened, she didn't want to be recognized. She scooped a handful of forest earth and scrubbed it onto her face. Kestrel became aware that the small sounds of reloading guns had stopped, giving way to the dull roar of the battle below. The gunners, crouched low like she was, regarded her. She stood.
"Which of you is truly brave?"
The Valorian vanguard changed tactics. They moved forward now, pressing Arryn's company back. A hand caught Arryn's arm, pulled him from the path of a charging horse. He turned. No one. Bodies and blood. And then, an eerie energy in his veins. A sharp zing that made his gut tighten and his guard go up, right before a tiny Valorian dagger flew into his vision, spiking through the air, straight for his throat. As the gunners fired, Kestrel sliced her dagger through the shreds of rope left tied to the stakes in the ground. She scavenged the forest floor for smooth, dry sticks of birch. Hands wrapped in broad leaves, she broke sappy twigs from the siren tree. Careful to keep her skin from contact with the flammable sap, she bunched the twigs together, holding them around a birch stick and one end of the rope. With a free hand, she wound the rope around the twigs and the birch stick. Then she held the makeshift torch beneath the dripping siren tree, letting drops of sap coat the rope and glue it down to the twigs.
"Exactly like that," she told the four soldiers who'd agreed to join her.
When they each had a torch and had taken a box of matches from the gunners, Kestrel said,
"Don't hold the stick upright until you must. The sap will run. If it gets on your skin, you might burn, too."
She told the gunners to fire two more volleys and then stop. She and the four soldiers began to run down the hill. Arryn dodged the small dagger. A needle. He knew that weapon. Needles were a set of six little knives. He caught the next one in his arm, flung up to block the dagger from his face. It bit into the exposed underside of his forearm, where his armor buckled. Then either his assailant had grown impatient with targeting from afar, or a new opponent had entered the game. As pain flared up Arryn's arm, somebody's sword crashed into his and knocked his weapon to the ground. Kestrel followed the scars made by the fallen trees in the forest. She skidded down the steep incline, the four soldiers following. A volley of gunfire shattered the air. A Valorian cannon boomed back. The cannonball crashed into the trees. They cracked. Broken branches hurtled through the air. A chunk of flying wood nearly hit Kestrel. Startled, she lost her balance and stumbled, getting sap from her torch on her chest armor. But she shouted, "Run!" They were nearly to the road. The second volley hailed down. Kestrel stopped the four soldiers at the edge of the trees, level with the road. Peering through the leaves, she saw that the guns had killed enough soldiers on this flank, that gaps in the Valorian defenses here were wide. She spotted the wagon that must hold the black powder. A Valorian stepped out of it, lugging a cannonball in his arms. "Not that wagon," she told the four. "I'll take the one next to it. The rest of you each choose a different wagon. Ready?" Kestrel's fingers trembled as she opened the matchbox.
"A commander never shows fear," her father said.
Her hand steadied. She lit a match. They set their torches on fire. Arryn dodged the swing of the Valorian sword. He pulled the needle free from his arm, felt pain spurt. Arryn briefly eyed his attacker, a slender, quick form. The Valorian lashed out again. "Just throw it and run," Kestrel told herself. "Throw and run." She burst from the trees. Her boots hit stone paving. A crossbow quarrel soared over her head. Another hit a Harani soldier running alongside her. He sagged and dropped. One of the four, a Dakran woman, snagged his torch from the ground and lobbed it at the nearest wagon. Its canvas cover flared into flame. Kestrel kept running. She couldn't see what the woman did with the second torch, but heard a howl of pain, a shrieking eastern curse. Kestrel understood only one word of it. Fire. The Siren sap, Kestrel thought. Maybe it had run down the woman's arm. Maybe the Dakran was burning alive. Kestrel forced herself to run faster. Valorian soldiers were scattered now, disordered, cut off from the general. She heard another wagon crackle with fire. She ran erratically toward her target.
"Never a straight line if you have to run," her father said. "Otherwise you're too easy to sight and shoot."
She got shot anyway. An arrow hit her chest. When the sword came at him again, Arryn sidestepped it and seized the hand that held the hilt, squeezed, felt the knuckles pop. The sound and the scream were lost amid other sounds and other screams. With the needle in his left hand, Arryn pierced the Valorian's wrist and saw the red point emerge on the other side. Arryn ripped the sword free, claimed it as his own, and stabbed. Kestrel staggered, but didn't fall. The arrow hadn't penetrated her armor. She had almost reached her targeted wagon. Heart slamming against her ribcage, she glanced up at her torch. The sap traced a thin blue line of flame down the birch stave. Her fingers were hot. She threw the torch into the wagon's belly. Then she spun and ran for the trees. Her legs pumped hard. She felt the old wound in her thigh split open and seep. She shouted the names of her four soldiers, cried out with ragged breath for them to run. "Run!" she called in two languages, and then a third. Even in Valorian, she shouted for people to flee, because her wagon was already a bonfire, and it was right next to the wagon that held the black powder. A breeze feathered her sweaty skin, a puff of wind. An explosion rocked the ground. The stone road shivered under Arryn's boots. Beyond the vanguard, above in the center of the Valorian army's column, flame shimmered the sunny air. A Valorian horn blew. The sound curled. Too pretty for war, Arryn thought.
"Stop thanking," said his god. "Fall back! Fall to the sides! The trees!"
Suddenly there was a halo of space around Arryn.
"Not yet," he murmured. "They're going to charge right up this road, right over you and everyone you're responsible for. Retreat! Now!
But the general, Arryn thought.
The god shrugged.
It's your life.
Do you truly care for my life?
A laugh. Arryn called for a retreat. From the trees on a hill, Arryn and what was left of his company watched the Valorians flee. They thundered up the road, as many, at least, as could run. The rear guard, caught between the fire and Rashar's company, had nowhere to go. 29. Later, Arryn learned that Rashar had eventually sounded a retreat of his own. The Valorian rear guard had been trapped by the fire, but their numbers still outweighed Rashar's. Desperation and excellent training made the Valorian rear guard difficult to overwhelm.
I have no particular interest in dying, Rashar explained, when his forces had regrouped with Arryn's on the Gunner's Hill. The loss of so handsome a man would do the world a great disservice.
The rear guard had fled. The road burned. When Kestrel had staggered up through the trees, a broken arrow shaft in her armor, her face dirty yet white around her wide eyes, Arryn caught her to him, exhaling deeply with relief. She reeked of smoke. Her armor was sticky with Siren sap. He guessed what she had done, and a tremor flickered through him even though she was safe. He pulled away, then saw that he had printed blood on her. Traces here and there. A faint red leaf marked her cheek. He saw her see him. He didn't like to think about how he must look.
Your father's alive, Arryn told her, sure that it was the wrong thing to say, even as he was sure that it must be said.
An emotion darkened her eyes. Later, after the fire had burned out and the road was a charred ruin littered with corpses, Rashar's soldiers had scavenged the remains, and Arryn had helped catch riderless warhorses, Kestrel finally spoke.
He'll resupply.
Her voice was flat.
The Empire doesn't lack for black powder. He might have to return to Ithria Island to get what he needs, but he'll hit hard when he hits next.
The stolen supplies and their wounded were loaded in wagons. The army made its way to reunite with the forces left behind at Aerolith. Outside Aerolith, in the meadow near where they had first made camp in this region, Arryn came to share Rashar's cooking fire. The sun had just set. The air was still heavy and warm, cast with a honeyed light. Rashar was smoking. He'd been in a foul mood since they'd left the fire-blackened road, though Arryn had reminded him that the battle was a victory.
I know,
Rashar had said, yet looked nettled. Arryn helped himself to warmed flatbread toasted over the fire. Soft bread on a military campaign seemed just short of magic. He ripped off a small piece and chewed slowly. Rashar glanced at him, huffed a little, but said nothing, which was disappointing, since Arryn had hoped to provoke the prince by taking his food. A Harani soldier passed close to their fire and moved on, though not before Arryn noticed that the man's eyes were rimmed with orange, like a Dacron's.
That's nice, Arryn commented to Rashar.
The prince choked on a lungful of smoke. When he stopped coughing, Arryn said,
Is it disrespectful that my people wear that paint?
Oh, no,
Rashar said, not sarcastically, yet with a bite that suggested that Arryn had missed the point.
It's nice.
Say what you mean.
I am not nice.
Arryn's brow furrowed.
True, but we're not talking about you.
We should be. We should absolutely be talking about me.
Arryn wished Rashar wouldn't do this, wouldn't slip on false arrogance as if it were mourning garb worn in the service of a joke. He opened his mouth to say so, then saw that Rashar looked genuinely troubled.
What's wrong?
Rashar said.
Do you remember how you attacked me in my city, in front of the Queen's Guard? To be fair, you had drugged and bound me. Do you remember how you were punished for that?
I don't see what this has to do with the paint.
That's because you don't understand your punishment.
Uneasy, Arryn said.
The Queen told you to choose my punishment. You never did. That entire audience with my sister was in Dacron, which you didn't speak or understand at the time. Or did you?
No.
I was your translator. I warned you. I said that you had to hope that I wouldn't lie.
Did you?
Let's say that I translated very loosely.
Rashar.
At the time, it didn't seem important. What would you care about the finer points of Dekrin law? And you didn't have anything worth taking.
What exactly did the Queen say?
That your life belonged to me.
Aaron, whose life had already belonged to many different people, felt his lungs shrink.
So yes, Rashar said. I have the right to decide your punishment, to kill you if I wish. By our law, I can also seize anything you possess.
You're not in Dakra. Your law holds no weight here.
My soldiers would say otherwise.
What do you want? Aaron's voice rose. My house?
This isn't entirely about what I want or don't want. But if we win this war, you'll have a prize very much worth wanting.
Aaron saw what he meant.
This country wouldn't be mine.
Oh, Aaron, please.
Aaron fell silent. They let the fire go out. Shadows had grown around them.
Puts my sister in quite an interesting position, said Rashar. It was a public announcement, one that she clearly didn't think through, though I'll be honest and say that when you fetched up on our shores, you didn't appear worth much. It cost her nothing then to offer me your life. It made for good courtly show. And now whatever is yours is mine. Despite its miserably cold weather, Heran is a pretty prize. Rich, fertile, a good buffer between Dakra and the Empire. My sister has a few options, depending on how this war plays out. If we win against the Empire, we could seize Heran by force, which normally wouldn't cause a fuss if it weren't for the fact that she'd be taking from me what our country considers legally mine. I happen to be popular with my people. Another option, she could ask me to give Heran to her.
You wouldn't.
Because you and I are friends.
How touching.
And naive.
That's actually what I like about you. You're so endearing sometimes.
I'd never let you. You'd have to kill me. Yes, little Harani, I know.
Rashar set aside his pipe. He brushed his hands as if cleaning them, then looked down at their emptiness. Aaron was no longer angry.
You wouldn't, he said again, or you'd never have said any of this to me.
I'd like to think that, but we're talking about the same person who deliberately let his little sister be taken hostage by his enemy. What will you say? That we all make hard choices? Do things we regret? Betray our best selves?
Yes, exactly.
I have wanted to tell you. I didn't. Not for months.
What did you think would happen if we lost?
Usually I don't think. Usually my sister thinks and tells me what to do. I'm quite comfortable letting other people run my life.
You never say what you really mean.
Rashar held his eyes.
If we lose, I'll take you home.
Your home.
Mine, yours.
Not possible.
Rashar sighed.
Well, lots of things are.
Your sister,
Aaron flashed.
Oh, that.
How does that play into this?
Well, that, as I understand, happened in my city when you were just a ragged, trespassing foreigner of little importance. Of course,
Rashar gave him a sidelong look.
You have your charms. Now you've put an end to that, which I don't know. I think that if I were you, I wouldn't have. Your country could always be returned to you as a wedding present.
Aaron made a frustrated sound.
It might be better for you if you didn't draw everything in such rigid lines.
Rashar thumbed more tobacco into his pipe.
It might be better for me if I did.
You know how I feel, where I stand.
Rashar arched one brow.
Indeed.
30. Kestrel stopped short of where the prince lay on his back, in the grass in the midst of camp, eyes loosely closed against the sun. It was rare to see his face relaxed. The sun showed how scar tissue had thickened his upper lip and knotted where the tip of his nose had been. She knew he wasn't sleeping.
Lazy, she accused. This is how I look when I conspire.
No Valorian commander would let his soldiers see him like this.
This is a strategy, she snorted. It is.
His eyes were still closed.
Aren't you going to ask me how it is?
She towed him. He stretched like a cat and seemed to settle back into position. Then his hand lashed out, seized her ankle, and yanked her leg out from under her. She landed on her rear.
Yes.
Rishar's black eyes glinted as she spluttered.
A masterful plan. Divine.
Kestrel kicked him.
Shh. Lovely lady, won't you hear my plan? It is the very best. You'll like it. Here it is. I am waiting.
Sunbathing.
Waiting, I say, for you to tell me what to do.
She told him exactly what he could do.
Such language. Did you learn that from Arryn? Stop kicking, little ghost. We're in full view of the camp. Weren't you just haranguing me about my honor? How can I cultivate respect in the rank and file if you kick me? Now, truly, look at my absolutely serious face as I say this. What would you have me do? More to the point, what will your father do?
Kestrel went still.
A move must be made, said the prince.
Larilyn. Kestrel had learned of the Valorian's failure to invade via the beach there. She knew how smooth the terrain would be from the beach to Haran's city.
If victory is slow, her father would say, it becomes increasingly harder to grasp.
He must wince from his defeat along the southern road. How could he wreak the most damage in retaliation? He could claw victory to himself by regrouping his forces to land at Larilyn with overwhelming force, with countless cannons and soldiers spread thick and wide. A costly victory. But if achieved, it'd lead to a rapid seizure of the city. She told Rishar to garrison a contingent at Aerolith, to hold what they had well defended, and move the rest of his army west to reinforce the Dacrans stationed at Larilyn. As she saddled Javelin and tightened the girth, she tried to quell the leaping worry in her belly. She should not worry. After all, what could the general do that she could not do? Had she not learned war at his knee? Did his voice not haunt her? She thought about the way her memory, or imagination of him, seemed to advise her. She didn't like the way he was right, how she listened. She wondered if there was any difference between how she listened to him and how Arryn listened to his god. Hilly terrain smoothed as the army rode west. The land grew slightly arid. The dirt was a light grit. Kestrel saw how the Harani soldiers lured Arryn into riding with them in the middle ranks. There were requests that he consider the gait of an unruly horse, or a story left dangling, a teasing challenge. Finish it, Arryn. Why don't you? If you can. Sometimes a question. Was Arryn sure he wasn't related to the Harani royal line? This flustered Arryn, and was so likely to hold him in extended conversation and vigorous denials that it was the most common ploy used to keep him in their company. Once, when Arryn let his horse fall back to ride with the Harani, Kestrel caught Rishar's sliding gaze, pensive, murky, a strange mixture of satisfaction and displeasure. Kestrel said, I thought you wanted them to love him. Rishar glanced over his shoulder at Arryn in the middle ranks. They rode in silence beneath the hard blue sky. Then Kestrel said, On the tundra, Arryn had a ring with a stone in it. Did you give it to him?
Never lend that boy anything. Careless. He lost it.
It could put people to sleep.
Yes.
And that white salve, the numbing one, is that Eastern too? Is it made from the same thing?
What an observant ghost you are. Yes, Kestrel. The liquid in that ring and the salve contain different quantities of a poisonous worm from our plains. A very little bit, mixed with ointment, will numb the skin. More will send you to sleep. More still, you take the goddess's hand and live with her forever.
Why don't you dip crossbow quarrels in it? I remember my father complaining about the poisoned arrows of the Eastern Plains people.
Alas, we are far from the plains, and my supply is limited.
He squinted at the sun.
Why do you ask?
She was quiet. He said,
You're not thinking about crossbow quarrels.
Sometimes I have trouble sleeping.
In case I wasn't clear, that part about taking the goddess's hand means dead. As in, you die. In its highest concentration, you can die from simply touching the poison, even when the liquid dries.
I'd be careful. Roshar swiveled his horse in front of Kestrel's, blocking her path. Javelin snorted and stopped. The prince said,
My answer is no.
He said,
You're not the only one who suffers.
He said,
You could do what the rest of us do.
Roshar spurred his horse ahead. Kestrel looked down the open road. A lone blackbird cut across the sky like a crack in blue paint. She thought about the white salve in her saddlebag, the missing ring, and how much she longed to sleep easily, without dreams.
Nothing in dreams can hurt you,
her father had said, which was another way of saying that life can. But she hadn't understood that as a child. Kestrel recalled the old comfort of her father's words, and had a sense of herself as she had been. That night, alone in her tent, she thought about the cruel cold of the tundra, sulfur crumbling in her grip, the panic when her memory had begun to slip, the nighttime drug, soft, dense, the fear of dying far from home. No one would have mourned her. Sorrow, like marrow in the hollow of a bone. It had been real, it still was, but it wasn't the whole of who she was. Kestrel blew out the little lamp. In the dark, she recalled the road she'd traveled that day with its cloud of dirt.
You could do what the rest of us do.
She would keep going. That night, she slept deeply. Afterward, she sometimes still wished for the nighttime drug, but it no longer held her in its power. In this region, a variety of wheat flourished. Dull gold fields rattled softly. The grain, fully flowered, bent the stalks. In the distance, Harani harvested the fields. They were too old or too young for war. Other fields had been abandoned. Kestrel saw farms where chicken coops stood empty, smelling of sour straw. The animals had been slaughtered or carried away. A woven basket, left outside for months, had disintegrated into a spiky nest. When grasped, the handle came off. The farms unnerved her. She would have preferred to say that it was because of the waste. Most of the wheat would rot on its stalks. But it wasn't that. It was the buildings. The rare Harani villa, with a columned portico and fluted arches. The wink of an atrium's glass roof. More common, a splendid and newish Valorian manse, sprawling, flat-faced. The slave quarters blistered in the sun. Paint peeled in long curls like an apple's skin. Kestrel noticed, with queasy misgiving, that a little house lay near the slave quarters on each farm. At first, when she went with soldiers to forage for provisions to fatten the army's supplies, she hadn't known what the little houses were for. There had been no such house on her father's property in Harran. One day she saw Arun see a small house. His eyes tightened. His expression went bleak. She knew then that the houses had been for children. The memory came unwillingly, sticky and slow. She had to drag it out. When she did, she understood that the knowledge had been the sort of thing she had once tried to unknow. It had been the practice to take a baby from its enslaved mother once it was weaned and sell it to a neighboring farm. The mother would be distracted from her work, went the Valorian wisdom. Meanwhile, her master would purchase other children from other farms. These children forgot that anyone but their owners could lay claim to them, and were raised in small houses by an elderly slave. By now, such a child could be as old as 10 years. It had been commonly done in the countryside. In the city, not always. Some owners prided themselves on allowing their slaves to keep their children. Kestrel had once seen a Valorian lady coo over a Harani child. The tiny girl had wobbled where she stood in the center of the parlor. Kestrel, who had come for tea, hadn't noticed the girl's mother at first, then had followed the toddler's gaze to see a uniformed woman waiting in a shadowed alcove. Kestrel's father had made clear that there would be no slave children on his property. If babies were born, they were soon sold. None were purchased. Each little house on each farm was a horror. Before, for years, she had let her mind close seamlessly, like an egg, around this wrong and other wrongs. They happened every day. It was life, but not her life. Hers, an inner voice, sinister, upsetting, had sometimes disagreed. Not hers. Hers. The words echoed now with the rhythm of Javelin's hooves. Kestrel could say that she'd learned that one's life is also the lives of others. A wrong is not an egg, separate unto itself and sealed. She could say that she understood the wrong in ignoring a wrong. She could say this, but the truth was that she should have learned it long before. The sky was frosted with stars. Kestrel found Aaron seated near a fire, squinting as he retooled someone else's leather armor. A buckle had come off. "Can you see well enough?" She remained standing.
"No."
He pushed an awl through a strip of leather.
"But there's no time for this by day."
The army pressed as rapidly west as it could, though not as quickly as Kestrel would have liked. Roshar had warned against a forced march. Weary soldiers make for lost wars. Her father had often said the same. Kestrel tipped her head back. The night glowed.
"How do you make a mirror?"
Surprise tinged Aaron's face.
"Do you want a mirror?"
"No, I just wondered how."
"Use silver glass. It's not something I've done."
She turned in a half-circle to look toward the western constellations. Her boots released the scent of bruised grass.
"Before, people must have used polished metal."
"Probably."
"Or bowls of dark water." "The sky looks like a mirror, if a mirror was a bowl of black water."
There was a silence. Kestrel took her eyes off the stars and looked at him. He'd set aside the armor and was turning the awl in his fingers. He flickered orange and red in the light of the low fire. Quietly, he said,
"What are you thinking?"
She was hesitant to say. He came to stand next to her.
"Aaron, after the conquest, what was it like for you?"
"I'm not sure you want to know."
"I want to know everything about you."
So he told her. The stars, too, seemed to listen. They left the wheatlands. The soil became loose. Fresh water, seldom. On the fifth day out of Aerolith, however, they reached a stream and replenished the water barrels stowed in the supply wagons. Kestrel watched Roshar approach Aaron as he curried his horse.
"Here."
The prince thrust something at him.
"Do us all a favor. You're filthy."
Roshar looked him over.
"I think there's still dried blood behind your ears."
It was a cake of soap. Aaron appeared faintly startled, as if he lived in a world where soap hadn't been invented. He broke the round between his hands and offered Kestrel half. It crumbled a little in her grasp. Its scent was sweetly smoky. She stood there, longer than necessary, inhaling the gift of a gift. It occurred to her that if she used it, and Aaron used it, her skin would smell like his. She tucked it carefully in her saddlebag, wrapping spare clothes around it so that it wouldn't be broken.
"Come with me."
Aaron, eyes illuminated.
"I want to show you something."
Kestrel followed without question, though the army's midday rest was nearly over. They took their horses. She kept stealing glances at Aaron as they rode toward a grassy hill. He caught her at it.
"A secret," he said, and smiled.
It felt as if his smile became hers, his secret, too. The day itself, the satin sky, a speckled yellow feather that spiraled down on a breeze to catch in Javelin's mane. She held all this inside her, the way a jewel holds light. They dismounted at the foot of the hill. Kestrel noticed stone steps, overgrown with green, leading up the slope. It occurred to her that the entire hill, rare for this terrain, might have been man-made.
"What is this?" she asked.
The stairs, as far as she could tell, led to nothing. The hilltop seemed bare. Arryn plucked the yellow feather from Javelin's mane and tucked it behind her ear.
A temple. At least it used to be.
She touched the feather's ticklish plume, the slight scratch of the quill. She explored it, trying to ignore her pleasure at his unexpected gesture.
Is that your secret?
You wouldn't ask, Arryn's grin was mischievous, if you didn't guess that it is not. Come see.
The steps were broken in places and wobbled beneath Kestrel's feet. When they reached the hilltop, she could see the jumble of marble that had been the temple's foundation. Perhaps it had been destroyed after the conquest. The Valorians had razed all Harani temples to their gods. But these ruins looked ancient. The marble was bleached bone white. The carvings, polished smooth by time, were blurred and mostly indecipherable, like a dream after one has woken.
It's greener here, isn't it?
Arryn's voice was hushed.
Than the rest of this region.
Yes. There were birds' nests in the nooks of broken marble. A lizard darted over a fallen pillar. The place appeared at once ghostly and yet full of life. When Arryn stepped into the center of the ruined temple and knelt, Kestrel thought it was to pray, but he was clearing away vegetation.
I recognize some of this.
He was eager. His words tripped over each other. He seemed unaware that she wouldn't understand what he meant.
But other parts. I thought I knew all the stories.
Kestrel came to kneel beside him. A face glittered up at her beneath strands of ivy. Startled, she pulled the greenery away. It was a mosaic. An entire immense tiled floor stretched out of sight beneath the vegetation. Kestrel palmed away dirt. The face flared in the sun, its tiled features slippery and cool. The man, woman, had wings fanned wide, a peacock's colors, scaled skin, carnelian claws. Kestrel tugged more ivy free. Gorgeous, impossible creatures appeared. An enameled snake with six tails, a horse made of water, a woman whose hair appeared to be paper scrolls written in a script close to Harani, but with so many alien elements, Kestrel couldn't read it. Some of the figures looked only vaguely human. A string of eyes crowned a brow. One long, violet-skinned body had no limbs. Gold spilled in a ribbon from the lips of a god. They were all gods. They could be nothing else.
Maybe we should go back, Arryn said.
But he didn't mean it. His mouth was reluctant. He licked his thumb and rubbed a tile clean. Not raising his gaze, the sun tumbling in his messy hair. A wide blade of light cut across the bridge of his nose, warming his neck and shoulders. He moved, and the sun caught his face in full. Her limbs were light, as if with fear. Her blood seemed to float. She said, "Not yet," and saw his sudden happiness. She helped him clear the vegetation and expose the entire mosaic to the sky. Every chip of her being slid into place, into the image of a lost world. The boy discovering it, the girl who sees its spark and flare, and understands now what she feels. She realizes that she has felt this for a long time. Lapis lazuli, kiln-fired glass, onyx and gold and shell and ivory, jade, aquamarine. Kestrel barely saw where each tile of the mosaic joined, the taut line of contact, piece to piece. She pressed her palm to its surface and imagined its image imprinted on her skin. Later, Kestrel wished she had spoken then, that no time had been lost. She wished that she'd had the courage that very moment to tell Arryn what she'd finally known to be true, that she loved him with the whole of her heart. 31. Kestrel was unusually quiet on the last day's ride to Larilyn. At first, at the temple, Arryn had thought that some new, delicate thing had grown between them. But since then, she had kept her distance in a way he couldn't explain, could find no cause for. He sifted through his memories of the temple, of her, the hot green leaves, the slick tile, the hidden world of the mosaic, and how Kestrel had wanted to see it, too. He could find nothing wrong. An error lay somewhere, that was sure. Still, each moment of each memory of that day made him want to hold them all in the palm of his hand, to stash them safely and close, in a deep pocket, perhaps, on his person. He was wary of this impulse. He suspected that he would be revealed as a child with a collection of precious things that were actually nothing valuable. A button, a river rock, a bit of string, or a speckled yellow feather. He wished he'd kept it. He wondered if Kestrel had kept it. Most likely it had fallen from her hair as they'd galloped from the temple's hill to rejoin the vanguard of the army. Tawny grass rippled on the bluffs. The air was brackish. They'd soon reach the sea. When the army stopped to water the horses from the barrels among the provisions, there'd been no fresh water in this land for 2 days. Arn found Kestrel brushing Javelin's coat. She glanced up at him, then away, her gaze settling on something else that Arn wanted to identify, to understand whether it was him or... what? The white-threaded sky? That gull tipped up against the wind? That made her seem suddenly smaller. Her hair had reddened since coming to the south. Her skin was now the color of toasted bread. Long fingers plucked stray bits of nothing from Javelin's mane. It was not the sky. It was not the gull. Arryn tried to set her at ease.
"So, strategist, what are our chances? Or do we ride to our dooms?"
The corner of her mouth lifted, an acknowledgement both of his effort to ease her anxiety and also that what he'd asked, however lightheartedly, was an odd sort of way to do it. Yet it worked. She became more present, the skittering movements of her fingers stilled. Not the battle, then. Not her horse, nor the slight crunch of sand beneath their boots. Nothing. Nowhere. Him.
"There are 3 scenarios, she said. "We arrive late, and my father has seized the beach. Or we arrive as reinforcements for a battle that has already begun. Or we arrive before my father and wait," she added.
"Of course, there is a 4th, but I am wrong. He won't land there, and we've disastrously shifted our strengths where they shouldn't be."
"There is no 4th.
She shook her head.
"I can be wrong."
"Is that what worries you?"
"Even if I'm not wrong, and we arrive before the Valorians land, it's a mixed blessing. Him landing late means he's landing with a larger force, a robust artillery. More people and more cannon take longer to mobilize. They're also harder to defeat."
Javelin knocked his nose against her shoulder. Arryn saw her smile. A quiet, lost feeling stole over him like sleep or a farewell.
"I told my father I loved him."
Her words were abrupt.
"It was the last thing I said to him."
Arryn didn't look at her. He didn't want her to see his face just then.
"I saw a basket when we were in the wheatlands," she said. "It had lost its shape entirely. You couldn't hold anything in it. You couldn't hold it."
"Kestrel, you're not a basket."
"I think..."
She stopped. He wondered if something can be so hard to say that it becomes hard even to say that it is hard.
"You can't tell me what you think?"
"No."
"Why?"
She whispered.
"I'm terrified."
"Of the battle?"
"No."
"Your father?"
Her voice was flat.
"He should fear me."
Arryn didn't want to relax his sinewy need for the general's death. It clenched inside him. But if it was this, if there'd been no error at the temple, if Arryn had done nothing that he needed to undo, and instead, what had made her seem to try to hide from him in plain sight was dread of Arryn's vengeance, or her own.
"Kestrel,"
he put it bluntly. He couldn't think of any other way.
"Do you want his death?"
Her eyes flashed.
"I won't do it," he said, "if you don't want it."
"Kill him if you can. I don't care. He left me for dead. Worse..."
Arryn's hatred knotted within him.
"If I did, would you forgive me?"
"You talk as if his life or death was your choice."
"It's been promised."
She squinted at him.
"By your god?"
"Not in so many words, exactly."
She shook her head.
"Please answer my question." Maybe it will be my hand, she said. My sword.
I need to know your choice.
Do it. Her eyes were wet. Swear that you will.
The knot released.
Yes, of course.
He changed us both.
She seemed to struggle for words.
I think of you, all that you lost, who you were, what you were forced to be, and might have been, and I have become this person, unable to...
She shut her mouth.
Castrol, he said softly, I love this person.
But her slim mouth tightened, her face shone again with fear. Arryn curled his fingers into Javelin's mane.
I am what troubles you.
No, Arryn.
But she had hesitated. He thought about what it meant that Kestrel's father had had her love and had cast it aside. He wanted to tell her about the jolt of recognition that had rattled through him when he'd ripped the ivy from the face of his god, how it had been like looking into the black water mirror Kestrel had described as they'd gazed into the clear night sky. He wanted to explain his hard joy, his relief of feeling fated for something, and how mattering to his god was akin to becoming a son again, or a brother. He wanted to warn her, to say that she couldn't know, not fully, what it was to no longer be someone's child. Kestrel asked,
Are you afraid of the battle?
This, at least, was easy to say. His smile was free.
No.
The beach was quiet. Which wasn't true, of course, not with an entire Dacran regiment camped on its sands. But it quieted Arryn to see that the Valorian ships hadn't landed, that there were no sails on the horizon, and even if Kestrel had warned that this could translate to an overwhelming onslaught, he was glad to see the empty stretch of rain-darkened sand from the tents to the shore, to see the low tide, the muck of green-plastered rocks, the gulls squabbling over crabs as they picked through tide pools. The wind was dead, the sky a flat slate. It had stormed the night before. The briny air smelled raw. Rashar's people were so glad to see the arrival of their prince that Arryn doubted the way Rashar styled himself as someone with no political ambition. The queen had her people's fealty, Rashar their love.
This is a safe time of day, Kestrel said.
Then knead her horse in the direction of the pale grass on higher ground, beyond which, they'd been told, was a stream that watered the army and its horses. Arryn followed, drawing his horse up alongside hers.
Yes, the Valorians will land at high tide, he said.
Kestrel looked slightly startled, not at what he'd said, but that he'd spoken at all, which made him think that her words hadn't been a start of a conversation, but rather just a moment in her mind that had somehow slipped out, and that she'd been deep in her own thoughts. She didn't bother to ask how he knew what she'd meant, probably because she assumed that the advantages of high tide for an invading force were obvious.
"The sea will carry them swiftly to shore," murmured Dath. "It will froth white, bear the weight of countless black-throated cannons."
Arryn glanced at Kestrel. This battle would be very different from the ambush along the southern road. There would be no safe place, only the open arena of the beach.
Don't look at her, Arryn. Look at me. You will embrace them. Your heart will rise, high and glad. What is an enemy? It is the stick and pull and slash of your sword. It is the clean path you cut between you and what you want. It is the path to me.
The human stench of the camp had lifted. Kestrel and Arryn had ridden far enough away. There was only the swampy saline of low tide, the exposed underbelly of the sea. It smelled good.
"You can wonder about her all you like," whispered Dath. "But I am the only one who will have you."
Kestrel had ridden a few paces ahead. She turned, catching Arryn's glance. A bead of rain fell on his cheek, the back of his neck.
"You are mine. I am yours. Is it not true, Arryn?"
Her expression closed. He thought of a box shut so firmly that one cannot see its seams.
"Yes."
That night, Arryn stood with Kestrel and Rashar on the bluffs. Moonlight glazed the sea. The water sparkled black and white. The moon coated the sand with silver.
"Pretty," Rashar commented. "Though it puts me in mind of pure worm poison."